Welcome to CFO Talk. I'm your host, Steve Rosewald, Chief Learning Officer at CFO.University. Joining us today from Salt Lake City is Paul Barnhurst, the FP&A guy. Literally, he is the founder of the FP&A guy. Paul started his career as a procurement analyst and moved on to FP&A leadership roles at American Express, Solera, and DigiCert before launching the FP&A guy in February. He has degrees in management from Brigham Young University and a double master's from Arizona State University, including an MBA in finance and a master of science information technology.
Thank you, Steve. The pleasure is all mine. I'm happy to be here and just spend a few minutes with you today.
Well, you know, we want to get deep into FP&A and we want to get deep into a specific part of FP&A, and that's pricing. You know, with inflation running rampant and supply chain issues gouging revenue forecasts, we have interest rates rise and there's all this stuff coming at us. Product pricing has become such an important area for a lot of companies. And recently you wrote a nice article for us, The Role of Finance in Pricing. And so I'd like to take a few minutes and ask you a couple questions about FP&A's role in pricing. But in your article, you started out and you said, it's hard to get people to adopt this. You were saying, you know, companies aren't developing a really well thought out pricing strategy. And I'm just kind of wondering, why is that?
I was thinking about that, and I think there's a couple things of why companies don't spend more time on pricing and have that pricing strategy. One, if you look at the company, you often have a chief strategy officer or the CEO spending a lot of time on strategy. You have a chief financial officer, a lot of time on finance. You have someone over marketing. You have someone over sales. You have someone over product. Rarely is there, especially until you hit a large scale, a specific group for pricing. And so different companies have different ownership. Sometimes it sits in product, sometimes it sits in marketing. I've seen it sit in finance. Sometimes it's a combination. And so I think sometimes that strategy is a lack of ownership. It's not always clear on who truly owns pricing. And then I think another thing with that is it's very easy when you launch a product to just go with what the market's done and think, well, it's about the features I provide and it's about efficiency and it's about my go-to-market. And the price will just take care of itself as long as it's competitive. And so I think those two things often limit the way companies look at strategy and pricing.
Kind of takes, it's a team effort, but once you create a team effort across departments, all of a sudden ownership gets lost. Who really owns it? But if you don't have a team effort, how do you really have a good strategy? And then the other concept, it'll kind of take care of itself. From a costing standpoint, I know developing a price that makes sense and gets value rather than just a competitive using someone else's price doesn't make a lot of sense. You can lose a lot of value that way. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that. Really appreciate that insight. And that's true. So having a strategy requires a team with a leader, I guess is how you'd say it. And that might be kind of hard to do across different product lines. You describe these four components and the roles that every pricing strategy should include. Could you remind us what those are? How they fit into the organization.
So there were four roles. There's a pricing leader, which kind of get back to number one there that we talked about, a pricing committee, customer data, and then a full understanding of your project margins is the fourth one of those four items. Having that leader, having somebody who's responsible for leading the committee, it doesn't need to be a full-time job, right? You don't need to necessarily go out and hire someone. If you have one product, they might spend a day a month on it or less. If you have a lot of products, you might need a full-time person, but you need somebody who has ownership. You need a committee so that you make sure you bring the cross-discipline together. You don't want the big, huge 30-person committee. We've all seen it where nothing gets done. You want it to be small, but you need a few people. Finance needs to be a part of that. Product team, marketing, the different groups that bring different perspectives and different voices to ensure you're considering everything. And then really having an understanding of your customer. If you're going to go beyond just pricing off margins, pricing based on the market, and really getting to value-based pricing, you have to understand what value you're providing to the customer. And without understanding the customer, you can't do that. And then the last thing that's really important is understanding your margins. We've all seen it where a product, due to allocations, due to miscalculations, you misprice a product, and sometimes you're losing money because you really didn't understand those margins. There are other areas, but it's one area in particular that finance brings a lot of value. Is really making sure those margins are understood.
Four points that are super important. The first one, do you find where the pricing leader, does that usually come out of a sales marketing? Have you seen it in FP&A? Where does that role typically lie? And does it matter?
I really don't think it matters. At one point, and you'll think this is interesting, this would have been over a year ago now, I put out an article that I said finance should own pricing. And it was a really interesting debate. Almost everybody who commented disagreed, but everybody who voted agreed. It was really funny. And the voting was like 70%, but they wouldn't put their name to it type of thing. And then a lot of people said no. And as we went back and forth, the conclusion I came to is it's really about having the discipline and the focus and understanding what needs to be done. It can be owned by finance. It can be owned by sales. I don't know that there has to be one place. I think we see that if you look around companies. If you ask who owns pricing and you talk to 20 companies, you probably get 5 or 6 different answers. Who ultimately, and I mean, at the end of the day, ultimately it lies with the CEO, but I think it's really about having the discipline and having the process and making sure you have the voices be heard. And you're making sure that you're thinking about your pricing in terms of your customer and driving value for your customer.
You used an example in the article that you wrote on the value proposition methodology for pricing that I found really interesting. You know, you kind of put bar ends on it. It was driven by the CEO, I think you said, had this real. Tell us more about that, because I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, it was one of his key pillars. It was a great learning and the concept I really liked. The value prop we used was a 4-to-1 to 8-to-1 is what he called it. And his idea was if you're giving the customer less than $4 of value for $1 a price, then you need to look to improve the product. If they're getting more than $8 of value for every $1 we charge them, then ideally we should look to increase the price. Now, obviously that depended on the product and market. That a lot of that was based on the original market that he started with, and this company continued to expand. You had places where it was almost a commodity product and you just didn't have that pricing power. But we always had to do that. And if it was outside that range to get any contract over, I think it was $100,000 approved, we had to explain why it was not within that value proposition. And we had to provide a calculation of how we determine that. So you'd work with product to come up with what the value is, making assumptions. And so it was automotive. All right, well, an oil change costs this, and this costs this. And to market to this customer that you're not getting costs this. We give this type of return. Therefore, we're giving you $100 of revenue for every $25 in marketing spend. Be an example of the calculation. Obviously, a lot of assumptions go into that, but they'd use that with customers as well in different things. And it was a very much ingrained in the culture.
You kind of talk it really casually, like, hey, this is just falling off a log. But to understand the revenue generation and the margin generation from the customer. So to get the value proposition, that means you have to deeply know your customer. Mm-hmm. And they have to be able to share information that a lot of times might be kind of hard to get unless they're going to share it with you.
And we were fortunate in that we were in an automotive industry. We got a lot of really good data for this company. So one example was marketing. Because we did marketing for the dealerships, we got all the repair orders. We knew what the value was. We knew who responded. So you could do those type of calculations. And some companies, that would be much harder, depending on the industry. My current company, it's a lot harder to determine that value. It's harder to kind of come up with that methodology because of the way the business works. But you could always come up with some proxy and at least get an idea of that value you're providing. And you should know what that range is as best you can.
Would you suggest that be kind of a standard practice, even if you, not necessarily for pricing, but from an understanding standpoint, you know, when you start those conversations, because for a salesperson, really almost not to know that, the marketing, not to have some at least range of value you're bringing, pretty hard, maybe to even sell the product if you can't, but you put numbers to it, which is what I like, rather than smoke and mirrors, this is what we think it'll do for you. You're getting tangible numbers to give your customers and say, this is going to give you a 4x return, period.
Value-based selling is great. Look at a company like Apple. How often do they discount things? Yeah. Rarely ever, right? Mm-hmm. Then you go to other companies like Walmart, and part of that strategy, but Walmart is discounting every day. Apple has built such a brand and has such a perceived value. Their pricing shows that we believe the value is right, and it's high-end premium pricing. You know, I don't know that they have ranges and buckets on all of it, but they've clearly been able to demonstrate to the customer, here's the value you were going to get, and we're extracting a premium price for that.
You really highlight the understand the customer, understanding, you know, really well. How does FP&A fit into that? If you think a lot of times finance is kind of one two steps away from the customer a lot of times. How do you suggest and how have you integrated FP&A and getting to know the customers really well to be able to do some of the analysis you're talking about?
I think it's going to vary a little bit by industry, but you know, in my experiences where I get to know the customers, really knowing the customer data, understanding, you know, from talking to the salespeople, some things about the customer. And I'll give, you know, a couple examples. We were working on a large OEM deal and I had learned all the components of the customer, what we focused on, where the pricing was different and things that allowed me to come in and intelligently have a conversation with the other people that, you know, the sales and the marketing. I had talked a lot to the account managers. In this case, I had done the commissions. And so I saw what the account managers were doing and the accounts they were managing and had a good understanding of the value we were bringing. And so we were able to sit down and intelligently not just discuss margins, but discuss strategy as we're trying to figure out how do we price this new deal? Oh, they want us to do that. Well, here's why that may make sense. And we thought of trying that. And so was able to help and work with that team to improve our margins on one of our big deals. And I don't think you have to have a ton of deep understanding within finance of the customer, but you have to have a good idea. And particularly on the financial piece, you really need to understand that. And you need to understand the product and have spent some time with sales and account management. So when those conversations take place and you get into the customer, you can add value versus just sitting there with your pencil and waiting for them to go, okay, what's the margin? Because they're looking for more from FP&A than just, all right, well, keep it above a 20% margin and I'll leave the room now.
But that does sound like the entry point, the discussion from the finance and FP&A is really understanding the financial component for customers. So being able to express that, it might be our margin. Mm-hmm. It might be, how do we make a stab at their margin?
Yep.
Everything going on in the market today that I mentioned earlier with the supply chain issues and all the inflation and working capital costing more and everything else, this whole pricing area is really important. And it's happening so fast. It's not that it's happening over 36 months. It's happening from month to month. And being able to understand the impact of that to us is really important. You know, when it comes to this customer data and the understanding, you know, customer value, there's a lot of finance leaders out there who are going to listen to this and go, boy, I wish I could get that close to what's going on with the customers and the customer data. For those finance teams that are kind of struggling to get in on the front part of what's happening in pricing, you know, do you have any suggestions for them?
First and foremost, if you're struggling, whether it's pricing or any area of the business, is focusing on the relationship beyond the reporting of making sure you understand what the needs of your customer is and that they understand how you can provide value. I identified within our pricing, one of the areas we had a need was our salespeople were over discounting. And so I work closely with our salesperson because some of the deals had to be approved by finance. And we agreed to work on those together in that we would be lockstep instead of having that conflict of sales. Well, I want to do this deal and I want to do it at this margin. I want to do that. We would always discuss all of them and align before we went back to the sales org. So there wasn't any disconnect and they saw that we were working together. So I think finding those areas may not always be initially in pricing, but finding those areas where you can drive value, where you can build trust and show that you're a partner will open up the opportunity. I mean, it got to the point in one company where I had times where they asked me what the price should be. And I was like, that's not my job here. Your product, you know, the market, what do you think the market will bear? I'll tell you margins. I'll give you my thoughts. And there's times I say, here's what I think should happen. Here's why. But I'm not the one who's going to assign the number. I'll approve that it makes sense financially, but I don't own that. Now that's kind of how I would couch it.
And that's getting out on the shop floor or in the sales meetings, really showing an interest in what they do. You'd mentioned in this case, you said, hey, they were over discounting. What were the clues that said, hey, you're over discounting? And how did you talk to them about that in the sense of you're not the pricing person? You're in the end, can you give us any examples of how?
Yeah, so there were a number of conversations. In this particular case, we had a system set up where there was a trigger. Kind of like, you know, committee over a certain pricing amount, any deal had to be approved by finance. And so I started getting a lot of deals. Okay. And some of them didn't even make financial sense. And what was the worst part is we found out originally is the system was set up where the customer could have already signed it. And then they were coming to me for approval. So the first thing I said is we have to change that. Can't be you come and ask me for a rubber stamp when you've already agreed to a contract we're going to lose money on. Right. And so how I would approach the salespeople is, look, I understand on this deal. And if we were losing money, I'd say, look, I just can't sign this. You need to go back. And usually they would, and they'd get a better margin. And then there were a few cases where they'd be like, okay, this really, this margin doesn't make sense. And they'd be like, well, here's what I've committed to. Here's the potential future opportunity. Say, okay, we'll make a one-time exception, but here's where we need to be. And I would discuss it with them. And they got to the point where they'd call me ahead of time. What makes sense on this deal? Where are our margins? Because they often didn't understand that. And so I'd get account managers and sales, you know, they'd ping me on Teams or they'd call me and we'd discuss it. So it wasn't me just getting blindsided with some margin that made no sense. And we really started to push. If you're constantly discounting and the sales leader was completely aligned, then you don't understand the product and you're not selling it on value. And so then they knew there was a training issue to talk to that salesperson.
What I'm really hearing you say, and you're saying some really great comments for people to absorb, but it's this, the concept that building a relationship stems from the curiosity, being involved and showing respect and working with people and coming halfway. So rather than scaring people out of ever coming to your office, finance can be the no department, right? It can be known as a no department. And if you can be known as the help department rather than the no department. And I think that just everything you've talked about, the way you've described how you deal with people, I think that's such a great lesson is be the help department, not the no department. And I think that's a great lesson for people. You close the article with 5 valuable lessons on pricing. And could you kind of reiterate those points for us?
So the first one that we talked about is, you know, every company should have a pricing strategy. Don't just price based on your competitor or price based on the feeling of the CEO. Give it some thought. You may not need a full-blown analyst to work on pricing, but spend a little more time than you probably are would be the first thing. And then every pricing decision should involve some kind of conversation about the value the customer is receiving. It shouldn't just be about what are our margins. You always need to take the customer into consideration. Ultimately, you may decide for whatever reason to make a pricing decision mostly based on margin, but make sure you've discussed the customer and you've thought about them in that process. Third is finance really needs to ensure that you have an understanding of cost margins for your products. And if you're using allocations, it's really important that you call those out. And I'll give one quick example is we had a call center and most people didn't take benefits in the call center, but we assigned a benefits number to every eligible employee in the company. And so that call center had a lot of heavy allocated costs for costs that weren't really being borne in that call center. And so I'd often adjust the numbers when we were trying to figure out what made sense and pricing to be competitive. Otherwise, it really led to bad decisions. And then the next one here is finance can and should play an active role in helping the business. Think about pricing as a strategic decision.
You almost put a commercial bent to finance when you're thinking about pricing and how you deal with people and how you deal with customers. And you have such an outside in rather than inside out approach. So really appreciate that. Mm-hmm. And let's turn to kind of your outside approach now with starting the FP&A guy. And I'm really curious, and I'm going to make a tough question for you in 3 minutes or less. Tell us about the FP&A guy and your journey in the last year or so.
It's been quite the journey. It really started 5 years ago when I was trying to find a job and somebody reached out to me, or I reached out to someone and said, hey, can I get you a Starbucks gift card if you'll spend 20 minutes with me? And they came back and said, I don't want your gift card. I want you to write an article for my website. I'm like, I'm a terrible writer, but okay. And I wrote it and it was kind of fun, but I still didn't get myself a good writer. And then he came back to me and said, hey, will you write some more articles? I'm like, oh, this is kind of fun. And then I'd occasionally write on LinkedIn and somebody asked me to be part of a webinar and things started to grow. And really about the end of last year, some people started to approach me on different arrangements saying, hey, would you be interested in doing a sponsorship or on some consulting stuff? And I went to my wife and I said, hey, we can turn this into a business. And she looked at me like, you're crazy, you know? And so I went, all right. And you know, it was still in my mind. I was still thinking about it and kind of talking to her a little bit. About a month and a half later, she came and she goes, you're right. I think you can make this work. And I said, okay, I'm going to give my notice to my job today. She's like, go ahead. And I did.
Wow.
You know, I'd been planning for a while and gave my notice and they asked me to kind of help out part-time for a while. And so that made a soft landing as I've worked through all this. And over the last 3 months, I've done some training. I've done some arrangements with different vendors, started my own podcast, FP&A Today. And we're putting out a market guide here shortly. And biggest thing right now is just trying to narrow it down and find out where I want to focus and how I can provide most value to the FP&A community.
For all those Paul Barnhursts who are kind of looking at that, hey, I've got this corporate job. Look what Paul's done. Is there one piece of advice you'd give them as they kind of
decision? I think the biggest thing, if you're looking to build more of kind of a name for yourself, reputation, brand, whatever people want to call it, is be willing to put content out there. Share what you learn. Everybody has a unique perspective and everybody can bring value, no matter where they are at in their career. And if you enjoy sharing that type of thing, you know, post something on LinkedIn, feel free to tag me and, you know, I'll comment. But, you know, put yourself out there is the biggest thing I would say, and whatever it is you want to do. But if it's in particular, you're looking to kind of go out and you want to share more of what you learned, don't be afraid to think you have something to offer.
Well, that's great advice. And I really appreciate all the information on pricing that you just talked about today and sharing your story with the FP&A guy and encouraging others to kind of take that leap and share what they do and giving some insight on how to do that.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, Steve. And I love what you're doing at CFO University. And thanks for giving me the opportunity to speak to your audience today.
That wraps up today's CFO Talk.